Hello and welcome to the Waterways Ireland podcast series with me, Turtle Bunbury. In this series, we are exploring the rich history of Ireland's waterways from the beginning of recorded time to the present day. Dr. Connie Kelleher is a maestro of underwater archaeology with literally hundreds of works to her name, books and theses and chapters, papers, magazine articles. Most of them are, as I say, about the world beneath the water. Dr. Kelleher is also the state archaeologist with the Underwater Archaeology Unit of the National Monuments Service, and it is a tremendous honour to have her on the Waterways Pod. Hello, Connie.
Hi, Turtle. How are you?
Very well, Connie. It's amazing. You've done so much work, especially around the coast, chasing pirates and smugglers and looking for the Lusitania and the Armada ships and all that. Can we start with yourself? How did you get into the wonderful world of underwater archaeology?
I suppose I've always had an interest in history when I was growing up with my grandfather and my father, and even my mother herself was more into the arts, but we were always as children taken around to sites. But back then you didn't really have a word for archaeology. You just knew that it was something ancient and
old stuff,
something to be respected and kind of amazed by. And I've always been interested since then. And when I went to college, my brother was a diver, so I took up diving with my brother, and I kind of saw the merit in joining my two interests, which were diving and archaeology. So I ended up doing underwater archaeology. And
brilliant. Okay, and where was that? Where were you diving?
Well, usually around the southwest coast. Cork or Kerry is where we would normally have done our diving. At that stage, my brother taught me to dive, so I went where he decided, which was always kind of cool places around South Kerry and the Skelligs and places like that. So primarily looking at the fishes and looking at the underwater environment, and really just feeling like it, you were stepping into another world. So then when I went to college and I saw our ancient kind of cultural heritage, I knew I could possibly step into that world through the diving as well. So
how clever. That is an ingenious move, Connie. I'm all in favour. Okay, so as we mentioned, you know, most of your work is about the coast, but the focus here is kind of on the inland rivers and lakes and the mm-hmm. canals to an extent. Have there been, you know, many finds on our inland waterways?
Yes. Our inland waterways are hugely rich in underwater cultural heritage and heritage along their riverbanks and on their shores. Up till now, I suppose my job is with the National Monuments Service, and we have focused an awful lot of our work on, as you say, on the coast, looking at the shipwrecks, building up our inventory of shipwrecks. But it wasn't really that we were ignoring the inland waterways. To the contrary, we just had to stage it in such a way that we were able to look at things comprehensively. But over the last number of years, we've been undertaking projects in the inland waterways, having identified from a very early time, long before the underwater unit was set up in the National Monuments Service, how rich the underwater cultural heritage was in our freshwater environment. So
sure. Okay, well, let's go back in time. Let's begin at the beginning. I mean, I know we've got Neolithic log boats on some of the lakes and some Bronze Age boats, I think, on the Boyne as well. What are the earliest boats we know of on Irish waters and lakes?
They date right back to the Mesolithic time. We have Mesolithic log boats from Loch Carrob. We have Mesolithic log boats from, say, Carrigdertie.
So with Mesolithic, just for the listener, that means we're talking, what, 5,000 years ago?
No, more than that. Anything up to 9,000 years ago.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, so isn't that amazing?
Yeah. Amazing. I mean, our ancient ancestors were using the rivers and the lakes as the conduits, as the mode of travel, really, primarily with log boats and dugout canoes, as they're often referred to. Really, they were our roadways. There was no real roadways within the land, terrestrial side of the country, so the waterways were our roadways. And I suppose that's indicative of the word road, comes from it's a marine maritime derivative of the word, so it comes from our roadsteads, which are which are our waterways. So they were the mode of travel, and they afforded you the opportunity to travel and communicate and meet and plunder and settle and fish and all of that. So there were both,
they were like the equivalent of an iPhone these days. They did everything for you.
They did everything, but they weren't going to burn your ear either with radio.
So with those early logboats and the canoes and so on, I know that in some of the rivers, the boats tell the story of the shape of the river. Sorry, what I mean is that the shape of the boat is different for each river, right?
Well, I suppose the shape of the boat is dictated by the tree that they're using for the boat itself to form the boat, to carve the boat. So, and it would also be dictated by what they were using the actual logboat for, whether it was just a single person, would it be smaller? Maybe if they were carrying cargo, then it would need to be deeper. If there were battle canoes, for instance, which are known about on the bigger lakes, they would have carried a number of men. So you would have, I suppose, fashioned your craft to suit what you were doing.
Yeah, absolutely. That's amazing, right?
Also, the availability of the actual resource, the availability of the timber that was there, and what the trees allowed you to do. So there was always, it wasn't really about the waters. Now, if you were going into shallow areas, obviously you'd want to maybe a shallow draft boat like you would even today. But really, it was about the use of the boats, that the type of boat kind of was fashioned to suit.
Yeah, okay, right. But you can actually tell, so the shape of those boats can also tell you some things about the rivers and the woods that were around the rivers, perhaps.
They can, certainly the material that the logboats are made of can tell you about the nature of the woodland that was present at the time, the type of tree, whether it was a young tree or an old tree, or if there was sapwood as part of the construction still remaining. And it can give you an indication of the actual environment that these people were living in. So it's not just about the technology and the craftsmanship in the making of them. They can tell you about the wider environment as well.
Wonderful. And you can date them, presumably, dendrochronology.
Dendro or carbon-14 dating is usually what we do, especially with the earlier ones, because, as you can imagine, you can do some coring for dendrochronology, but if they're too thin, if the remains of the logboats are too thin, we try not to actually cut them to take the dendro. We would have a preference for the carbon-14 because you only need a smaller sample then. So it's less impacting on the archaeology because the whole idea is to preserve as much of it as we can.
Sure, sure. And how accurate is that sort of dating at this stage?
It can be quite accurate, yeah. I mean, you're talking, you know, nearly 10,000 years ago.
Yeah.
It can be quite accurate to give you a good idea of the kind of time scales that you're involved, whether you're talking a couple of hundred years, probably, you know?
Yeah. Okay. Brilliant. Okay. So as we get closer to the modern age, I guess it becomes more easy to tell. And Connie, there was a 16th century clinker-built vessel in the Boyne that I think you had something to do with as well.
Yes. The National Monument Service excavated back in 2007 a 13-metre clinker-built vessel in the River Boyne that was discovered during the dredgings for the in the channel there by Drogheda Boat Company. And we excavated the full vessel, the remains of the wreck, known since as the Drogheda boat wreck. 16th century, it's early 1500s. Beautiful, beautiful. It's there from bow to stern. It had a cargo of barrels on it that were with provenance back to Bordeaux area of France, but they had been reused for carrying herring. So
were they originally wine?
They were originally wine, yeah. Mm. And the boat itself, we've provenanced the timbers locally. So they were north, the kind of area north of the Drogheda and kind of south of Armagh, that area where they built from the timbers that were sourced from that area. So it's undergoing conservation in the National Museum at the moment. So a really important vessel from a ship typology perspective, because we know we know little, very little from Ireland of that, those types of vessels, the clinker built from those early 16th century period. So it's a very important vessel from that perspective.
Brilliant. Okay, how exciting. Right, okay, well then let's go down to the other end of the country, down into, well, it's not quite the River Barrow, but Waterford Harbour. The probable, I think, is the words, 1645 wreck of the Great Lewis. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's another, now that's an ocean-going wreck. Again, found during dredgings. And when I say that, the National Monument Service would request that an archaeologist be on board when the dredgings are taking place, so that if they hit a wreck, the dredger can be stopped and moved to another area and the wreck site can be investigated. And that's how the remains of what is probably the Great Lewis of 1645 was discovered. So it's a substantial ship. It's buried in situ. We didn't excavate that. It's just too huge, and it's right in the river channel as you go up the harbour.
What did it do, the Great Lewis? What was it?
The Great Lewis was a parliamentarian ship under Cromwell in 1645 during the Irish Rebellion period. And it was moored above Duncannon Fort. And the fort was under siege from the Irish Confederacy and the Royalists. And they fired on the ships in the harbour. There was three of them, and as it's recorded at the time, the Great Lewis was caught by an unfavourable tide, so she couldn't get downriver, so she was bombarded from the headland there by the troops under Colonel Preston, and her sails were damaged, the ship was damaged, and she, when the tide turned, she was able to slowly kind of snake her way down the river out of arm's shot, but she was so badly damaged at that stage that she couldn't steer, and she grounded on what was Duncannon Bar at the time. Subsequently, in the 19th century, the dredgings cut a channel through Duncannon Bar, and that's the dredgings are keep that channel open now, even to the present day. But at the time, the bar was all across the river, and you could only get over it at high tide. And because the tide was too low, the Great Lewis grounded on Duncannon Bar. And there she lodged. And
that's as far as she got, right?
That's as far as she got. And we know she sunk into the kind of soft sands there, and over the centuries, kind of her upper works rotted away. And during the dredgings in 2002, the archaeologist on board was able to stop the dredger. And our subsequent investigations showed that you have a whole line of cannon still in their gun ports. Wow. So she's lying on her side, and buried deeply in the sand there. And quite an impressive ship by all accounts. She was a big ship.
Wow. Okay. That's a very, very exciting story that I'm sure we'll hear more of in the coming years. Okay. Well, that's the actual ships, I suppose. But what about the content? Is it's the stuff that's, I guess, lost in a shipwreck or maybe deliberately thrown overboard. I don't know if there's a difference, but I presume we find a lot of stuff that has literally come off boats.
There can be quite a lot of artifacts. It depends. I mean, you can have individual artifacts that in rivers, particularly, that maybe didn't come off any wreck. They may have been at fording points that may have been lost while people were crossing the kind of fording point, or many fording points were the scenes of battles, so they may have been battle paraphernalia, and the artifacts were lost at the time, or they could be votive offerings. Rivers have very much through time, as they still do today, have very much kind of a mythological and folkloric attachment, and to appease the river gods, you may have deposited artifacts as votive offerings.
I know that, we had listeners to the series might recall an earlier episode in which we were speaking about, I think it was when they were draining or dredging the River Barrow at Monastrevin in County Kildare. And I think they found hundreds of stone axe heads on the riverbed, which I think were votive offerings. Does that add up to you, Connie?
Yeah, could have been. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you find... you find every type of artifact really in the river. Over the last two or three years, there's local divers up in around Port Tumna and Shannon Bridge have been finding, just through their own diving, coming across artifacts, and we've been liaising with them on those discoveries, and they've been reporting them. because under the law you have to report anything like that. And you also, if you're diving on, you know, specifically for to look for archaeology, or you're specifically looking on an archaeological site, you need a license as well. So the law is very strict in that regard, but we work together as part of our job with divers who come across material. And the divers up in Port Dumna have been really, really helpful, and have come across an amazing amount of artifacts in a very, very long stretch of the river Shannon, stretching all the way from, you know, Banagher rather, right down to Port Dumna. So,
and what are we talking about? What sort of artifacts would they have found?
Anything from, they've found swords, they've found spears, they have found bottles, they have found jars, really bowls. We've come across material ourselves while doing our own investigations in some of those areas, following up on what the local divers have found. And also, and this is key as well, we found an awful lot of human remains. Now, whether these are individuals who have been lost overboard from a ship or a boat, or whether they have fallen in, or whether they was the scenes of a battle, we don't know really. They could be, of course, washed down from other areas. They could have washed out from ancient graveyards, because as we know, Turtle, the courses of rivers can change. And what was, you know, running by an archaeological site, which could have been maybe a burial ground, now maybe flooded and eat into the burial ground, and therefore human remains can be washed out and washed up or downriver. You know, but I suppose it highlights to us the need to respect rivers as grave sites as well. So as part of our job, we're not only the regulators, but we're also there to ensure the protection of the archaeology and ensure that we work with people to ensure that that happens.
Okay, yes. All right. So there's so many challenges there, even in what you just said there. I'm thinking, first of all, how do you work out all these different eras of history that are all like right beside each other because they've all washed into the same spot? I mean, that must be a complication in itself. Is it very hard to work that out?
It can be hard, or else it can actually be indicative of a site that has been used over the millennia. So it may be actually an archaeological site that you're dealing with. So it may not be just arbitrary artifacts. Generally it is, because they've washed down or washed into the river, but you may be dealing with a site that the kind of different period of artifacts or material that's in the river is indicative of the usage of the river and the usage of the sites beside the river over sometimes millennia. So you could have anything from the Bronze Age, the Iron Age, which is in one area we have, right up to the medieval period. So it's the archaeological evidence for the use of those places and environments and rivers and waterways over time.
Yes. Okay. Right. And you know, as you say, fords and river crossings are going to be, you know, something of a hotbed for such finds, I presume. Okay. And you also mentioned, well, I mean, in terms of finding things, I don't know if it's, I guess quite a lot of things have been found by accident or maybe by local diving clubs, but the challenge that you mentioned with treasure hunters, for want of a better word. So there are big steps, big things in place to prevent that, we hope.
Yeah, I mean, we have very good National Monuments Acts in this country, which afford protection to our underwater cultural heritage, particularly the 1987 Act, which affords full protection to all wrecks over 100 years old, for example. And then artifacts don't have any date cut off, so they can be right up to the early 20th century to our historic modern period. So we do have the legislation there to protect the heritage, but really it's about working with people, and it's about raising awareness, it's about educating, and it's about collaborating on what is, particularly in our underwater cultural heritage perspective and our rivers and our lakes and our seas, very much a finite resource, because when it's gone, it's gone. You can't, if you lose it, if you lose the context of something, if you pull an artifact out of somewhere, you've lost the context of that artifact. So it's ensuring that we can get as much information, work together on it. As I say, we have the laws to prosecute if we so wish, but we prefer to work with people.
And yes, exactly.
Again, it's like our divers and our fishermen, they're the eyes and the ears and they've got the knowledge of what's their environment in a way. And we prefer to work with them on it and work together on it.
Yeah, okay, that's good. That totally makes sense. I mean, aside from humans, well, maybe it still is humans, but what are the other sort of challenges to and threats to underwater archaeology? I mean, pollution is presumably pretty damaging.
Pollution or non-native species can be hugely damaging, particularly things like the zebra mussel, because they cling to the side of wooden artifacts, including logboats, and they just destroy it.
Munch it, yeah.
They munch it away. So the invasive species is a big issue. I suppose climate change is a big issue for us, where you're getting more rain, greater precipitation, and therefore greater flooding. So you're getting sites destroyed and artifacts destroyed or washed away. As well as that, you're getting a leisure craft, particularly on the inland waterways. And look, I mean, we're not in any way, shape or form against, you know, users of the waterways. But if you're near a known site, then, you know, you should be aware that you shouldn't be arbitrarily dropping anchors or dragging anchors or anything like that, because you could be damaging an actual site. So it's all about raising awareness as well in things like that. But climate change and that kind of aspect to it is a worry, because we're looking at that now again as part of our own work, and how to tackle that, I suppose. And again, it very much comes down to working together on it.
Yeah, okay.
Because it's affecting everybody.
So and then, is there a sort of central repository archive of where all these things, you know, where all the finds, could we find out about them on the internet?
Well, the finds that we've raised in the last couple of years up in the River Shannon and our colleagues, the divers, have raised, have gone to the National Museum. Our National Museum is the state repository.
So that's where the artifacts that you're finding, yes, that are removed from sites, they'll go to the National Museum.
Who carry out rapid first aid so that they stabilize the artifact, and then long-term conservation to do with the artifact itself. So they go straight to the museum, because that's the best option for preserving and conserving the artifact and ensuring its long-term preservation. So the National Museum really is our repository. We work very closely with our colleagues in the National Museum. And if anyone visits the National Museum, you can see on display many artifacts that have come in out of an underwater context. One of the biggest artifacts in the museum is the Lurgan logboat, which you see up against the back wall. No, it came out of a bog, but that was a lake at one stage. So it wasn't, you know, it was on the water before it turned into a bog. But again, you can see, many artifacts within the museum itself that have come out of a freshwater environment. And if you go to Collins's barracks, you can see the cannons, for instance, from the Armada sites that came out of a marine environment. So there's a lot in our National Museum from our underwater cultural heritage.
Absolutely. Well, I must chat to the National Museum directly, because I'm sure I was thinking about it, that when they were building the canals in the 18th century, and they were, you know, digging through all those bogs and everything to put down the Grand Canal and the Royal Canal and so on, they must have found stuff. I don't know if there's a record of what
there
they
is.
Found.
There is. There's records of all of that. And I suppose that was a time before the word, as I said at the very start, the word archaeology kind of came into its own, and you had the antiquarians kind of leading the fore on interest in in all aspects of our heritage, both on land and underwater. But really the dredgings, I suppose, of the late 19th century and into the 20th century highlighted the richness of our underwater resource for the first time. Many, many of the artifacts that were raised at the time highlighted the richness of our lakes, our crannogs, our other main river systems, the Three Sisters down in Waterford, or the Shannon itself, you know, which...
I was thinking that with the navigation works along the Shannon, you had all those thousands and thousands of fellas and all involved in building bridges and canals and weirs. I mean, they must have left stacks of stuff behind.
They would have. I mean, a lot of it is recorded. Some of it would have been lost, obviously. Now, our National Monuments Acts for the Protection of Our Heritage didn't really come into place until 1930. There were earlier acts that looked at preserving some of the heritage, but a lot of the individuals recognized the value of these and kept them, and they've subsequently ended up in the museum. So, but it's a real kind of a history of not only the works on our inland waterways, but what could be found in our inland waterways to do with our ancient past as well. So it kind of highlighted that for us.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Now, with the technology now in 2023 is quite something compared to what it was even 5 years ago. So how much more is there? Well, how much more is there to uncover? Who knows? But I mean, can you what excitements can you see lying ahead?
Well, we have a lot more to do in our linear waterways. We're only really, if you'll excuse the pun, scraping the surface of them. With our kind of geophysical capabilities now, where you can have multi-beam, you can cover far greater areas of the inland waterways than we could have before. Our colleagues in InfraMar, which is the National Seabed Survey, have done it for our coastal areas, but we really need to do more of it in our inland waterways. And we are doing a long-term project in the Loch Corrib. It's my colleague Carol Brady is overseeing that and directing it. And we have done an awful lot of survey work up there. There's a local man, Trevor Nortage, who undertook his own kind of surveys, not for archaeological purposes, but for navigation purposes, to remap the lake, basically to inform the use of the lake and the fishermen. And he started to come across logboats, so he reported them to us. And we've been working up there for the last nearly 10 years now. And so again, an awful lot of the logboats that have turned up through undertaking geophysical survey. So it's a way of using the current technology to inform on locations of potential archaeology as well.
Well, Connie, I am already giddy with excitement at what we're going to learn in the coming moons. It's so exciting.
Could I just tell you about one of my favorite artifacts?
Please do.
One of my favorite artifacts, and it's a natural heritage artifact as opposed to a cultural heritage artifact that we came across last year, and we were doing our projects up in the Shannon, is ancient bear. We found the skull of ancient bear, which is at least 3,000 years old, dating back to the Bronze Age.
A
Again,
bear, like an actual bear.
yep, an actual bear skull. We didn't realize what we had at the start, but we realized that it was a big skull and it was bigger than what a normal dog would be. And we called on colleagues who were more specialized than we were, and it was confirmed that it was ancient bear. And again, telling us about the environment back in the Bronze Age time, when our fellow human beings may have hunted bear, and the bear itself may have been hunted and ended up in the river. And that to me is really kind of bringing the natural heritage and the cultural heritage together, because we found the remains of the bear in the same place where we were finding logboats and other Bronze Age artifacts. So it looks like there was a vibrant Bronze Age community there at the same time as there were brown bears eating the grass while they were, or eating the men maybe, while they were there. But either way,
Right.
They ended up in the river. So I was particularly excited about that.
How cool is that? Well, listen, Connie, I want you to give a special thanks to your brother for introducing you to the world of diving, and then for you to skillfully pair that with archaeology so that we all now know about ancient bear. Absolutely brilliant.
I think my brother Nigel has still diving. I didn't put him off, but anyhow.
Good idea. Well, listen, keep diving anyway. Connie, look, thank you so much for all your insights and for that amazing wealth of knowledge you've made available through all your published work. And I urge listeners to go and look up Connie Kelleher. You'll be staggered by how many articles and things you've written. And if you'd like to know more about what Connie does or the underwater archaeology, go to the National Monuments Service website, www.archaeology.ie. And thank you so much, Dr. Connie Kelleher, State Archaeologist. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Waterways Through Time. You'll find more episodes on waterwaysireland.org or on Alexa, Spotify, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll find my archive of historical stories, mostly Irish, at turtlebunbury.com. My sincere thanks to series producer Ali Bunbury and technical producer Mary Burke.